hold these truths to be self-evident.
Dalion fod y gwirioneddau hyn yn hunan esboniadol.
That all men are created equal.
Fod pob dyn wedi ei greu yn gydraddol.
That they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights.
Fod yr holl alluog wedi ei breinio a iawnderau anamddifadadwy.
That among these are life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness.
Fod ymhlith rhai'n bywyd, rhyddid a hawlio dedwyddwch.
Welcome to Life, Liberty and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Our theme today is Wales and the Declaration of Independence. Today, there are about 3.2 million people in Wales. In the United States, 2 million Americans officially claim to be of Welsh descent, and roughly 10 million people have Welsh surnames. And indeed, the Welsh have been an important part of American history since its very founding. The first Welsh settler left for the colony of Virginia way back in 1642. About 130 years later, in 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was signed, 16 of the 56 original signatories were of Welsh origin, so a full 30%. And a large number of the founding generation, as well as the first presidents of the United States, were at least partially Welsh. And these include John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, and John Quincy Adams. Still, Welsh history is underappreciated in the United States for reasons that are not simple to understand or explain. Perhaps it's due to the fact that the historical relationship between Wales and England was not quite as bloody as the relationship between Scotland and England, or indeed Ireland and England, which were rather bloody. Perhaps it's due to the fact that it was easier for the Welsh to blend in to white Protestant English-speaking colonies. Maybe it was because their Welsh identity was not as strong as their British or American identity. Or maybe it's just because other immigrant groups soon outnumbered Welsh immigrants, diluting Welshness in the new United States. In short, distinguishing Welsh identity from English identity is both mysterious and complex, maybe in Britain, but certainly in the United States and the early colonies. So today we're going to explore Wales, Welsh identity, and the Declaration of Independence. What was Wales like in the 1700s? Why did the Welsh move to the colonies? What did they think about rebellion against Britain? And how did the Declaration of Independence influence Welsh politics back home in Wales? And here with me today are two fantastic experts on Welsh history to help us answer these questions, Dr. Marion Loeffler and Dr. Hugh Williams. Welcome.
Hello. Shomai.
Shomai. Diolch yn fawr iawn.
As they said, welcome indeed. So originally from East Germany, Marion is a Welsh speaker and reader in Welsh history at the University of Cardiff. She has published extensively on Welsh language and history and has researched and presented 7 history documentaries for both Welsh and German television and radio. She also appears regularly on Radio Cymru.
Radio Cymru.
Wales Radio. I'm doing my best here. Hugh is also a Welsh speaker and reader in philosophy at the University of Cardiff. His research connects questions of global justice and international political theory with the intellectual history of Wales and its progressive traditions of thought. He has also published a wide variety of writing in both English and Welsh, including a philosophy and current affairs column for the Welsh Literary Review. And for the purposes of this episode, he will be sharing his expertise on an underappreciated Welsh political and moral philosopher of the late 18th century, Richard Price. And Richard Price was a friend of many early American patriots, including Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Thomas Paine. So, That opening quotation that you spoke was obviously the famous lines of the Declaration of Independence in Welsh. And before we get to these historical subjects, maybe both of you could just talk about your personal interest in preserving the Welsh language and indeed growing the number of Welsh speakers in the world. Marianne, I think you're a great example of this, a native East German who is now adding to the numbers of Welsh speakers. So why is it important for both of you to focus on preserving and expanding the Welsh language?
Well, for me, it's not so much a matter of preserving. It is a matter of just speaking and living it. When I left East Germany a couple of years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, because the new United Germany was not very much to my liking. So, and because I'd been doing research for my PhD on Wales, I kind of did a flight into the Welsh language for some years. For some 5 years, I couldn't even read German literature. So I learned Welsh very quickly. I started publishing in Welsh. And because I lived in Mid Wales, in Ceredigion, where Hugh comes from as well, you speak Welsh there every day. So I raised my children in Welsh. We speak Welsh to each other. They both went through Welsh language education. So I've actually added 3 Welsh speakers. And for me, it's just when you move to a country, and I'm sure fellow Germans will kind of understand that, you just learn that language. And with that language, you access a different culture. You become a different being. You can reinvent yourself. And all of a sudden, 30 years have gone by and you have multiple identities, one of which is being Welsh.
Hugh, so you are a native Welsh speaker. That was quite a lovely little introduction to Marianne's history with the language. That would make me feel proud if I were a native Welsh speaker.
Yeah, absolutely. Language is life. A Canadian philosopher, Charles Taylor, that some people may be familiar with, wrote a book about 10 years ago now called The Language Animal, which is able to articulate and express everything that the language is. And I think one of the interesting intellectual aspects here is the way in which I would argue the Anglophone culture has a much more narrow idea and concept of what language is, and this is what Taylor gets to grips with in his book. And that makes for, you know, a difficult life sometimes when you're on the same island as we are, and there's not perhaps that appreciation of what language is and what is lost through a language. And so, you know, I'm articulating here, I suppose, ideas and thoughts that have percolated over a long period of time as a philosopher. But if you were to ask me that question in the bar or, you know, on a walk down the river, I suppose my first response would be, well, you know, that's my language, that's the language I speak. Why wouldn't I want to, as it were, reproduce and revitalize it? Because that's what every culture in the whole world does. But I think, as I say, perhaps for philosophical reasons, perhaps for political reasons, post-colonial reasons, if I can dare to use that word, there's a constant question against minoritized language communities and indigenous language speakers around, well, you know, why do you do this? If you were to ask an English person, why do you speak English? They would probably look at you in a very confused manner. So in a way, it's tempting to kind of respond likewise and just say, well, you know, why wouldn't I? Please, Marianne, if you want to, you know, jump in there.
Yeah. Can I just add, of course, Hugh is a philosopher. I'm only a humble historian. So one, you know, I said I moved to Wales and, you know, learned Welsh. The reason is, and, you know, this podcast is, it's to do with the pursuit of happiness, you know, the American Declaration of Independence. The Welsh were also the nicest of all the nations I met in the British Isles. If you have a kind of spectrum, everybody was so very, very welcoming, especially when I started learning Welsh, that you just can't escape it. You need to learn the language and you need to embed yourself in that culture because it's so kind. It's so open as well. Nobody has ever kind of turned around and said, you're not Welsh because you weren't born here. you learn the language, you speak Welsh, and you acquire that kind of birthright, which is not, you don't get that in every country.
And just to add one other brief thought to what Marion has articulated there around, I guess, the significance of the Welsh language for Welsh culture and the welcome that she had, you know, there may be a clue there as well with respect to some of your opening remarks about the Welsh communities of the US and the sense in which Welsh identity has not maintained its strength and integrity in the same way as perhaps the Scottish and the Irish. Some of that may be, you know, simple numbers, but there's something to, I think, question there around what happens to a culture when it loses its language. And that's what happened to the Welsh Americans. When the Welsh lost their language, they lost a huge amount of who they were, and, you know, also potentially lost their religion as well, or their method or way of expressing their religious identity. So perhaps something to come back to there, Andy.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was getting to by asking you, both of you, that opening question about the Welsh language. What I was basically getting at was the question, to what extent did the Welsh colonists in the 18th century travel as Welsh people or as British people or as Welsh English people, or to what extent was their identity when they were colonizing North America? How much did they consider themselves to be Welsh versus, say, British?
That is a very hard question to answer, Andy. I think the early Welsh colonists, they wouldn't have seen themselves as colonists, of course. They would have seen themselves as dissenters. When the first Welsh colonists went, they were Quakers, they were Baptists. So they go to America partly to escape persecution, partly, of course, because America becomes quite early this kind of utopia, but also because there are 13 colonies there and they are part of Great Britain. You know, they are, well, not part of Great Britain. There are 13 colonies there and they're part of that empire. They're part of that whole, of which they are part as well. So whether if you come from, you know, rural Ceredigion, whether you go to London, like many Welshmen did, to trade, to sell, to weave, to sell milk and so on, or whether you went to one of the 13 colonies, it was all part of the same empire. And remember, it was a Welshman, John Dee, astrologer to Elizabeth I, who invented the word empire, apparently.
Hugh, did you want to add something about the extent to which a Welsh person traveling to the colonies in the 1700s considered himself or herself to be primarily Welsh or something else?
Certainly, this idea of the Americas as being a potential site for, you know, Welsh utopias was a very important idea, and one that reproduced itself over, you know, more than a century of time. And there were other examples in South America where Welsh people looked to re-establish communities. And in that context, what's fundamentally important is this idea that you're able to establish your own administrative, legal, political structures that would be created and lived through the Welsh language. Certainly in the case of Patagonia, for example, which is maybe the most famous of the Welsh colonies, that was what drove a lot of the, I suppose, inspiration behind that movement, that transatlantic movement. There are other figures we might come back to, such as Morgan John Rhys, who reflect this religious dissenting tradition that Marion refers to. And amongst those, certainly one would assume that, you know, Welshness was core to, you know, their beliefs and what they were doing and why they went across the Atlantic. They were, of course, contemporaries, and obviously come on to Richard Price, who maybe would have regarded themselves more as Brits, or they may have referred to themselves as English also. And that would depend on the sort of degree of separation, I suppose, from perhaps Welsh language culture and the homeland itself. So, you know, in the context of somebody like Price, he might have regarded himself maybe as a Brit or an Englishman, as much as he would have regarded himself as a Welshman. So, you know, I imagine there's a spectrum here.
Marianne, yeah.
Of course, the situation is complicated somewhat that the Welsh, until the end of the 18th century, they call themselves the Ancient Britons. So when they say they speak British and when they call themselves the Ancient British, they mean Welsh. But once Great Britain has been founded, this is overlaid with political Britishness, and the two kind of meld together. And you get pamphlets and you get ballads, and all the Welsh societies in London, they confirm again and again that we may speak a different language, the ancient British, the Welsh language, but we are loyal Britons politically because we're Protestants. So there are some very complex issues of identity going on here, and that kind of changes a little bit towards the end of the 18th century, as Hugh said, with people like Morgan John Rhys, and then into the 19th century, it becomes much clearer, that kind of multiple identity. But you know, to be Welsh is also to be ancient British, is also to be politically British in the 18th century.
Fascinating. And I just want to follow up maybe with a question about the word you use, dissenters, and this religious angle. I think maybe you need to explain to our audience what you mean by dissenters.
So what happens in Europe in 1517 is, of course, the Reformation. You get Luther, you get Zwingli, you get Calvin, and you get a lot of, you know, Protestant little duchies and kingdoms and so on in Europe. And then Henry VIII in the British Isles want to divorce Catherine of Aragon. And in order to do that, he breaks with Rome, but he founds an Anglican state church, which means that he's the head of the church. And this is the only Protestant state church in Europe, I think. And those who dissent from that state church are called dissenters. In 1689, with the Act of Toleration, they are allowed to, and I quote, worship in unlocked chapels, but they can't inhabit government posts. They cannot go to university. That's why you get all these dissenting academies where all these radicals like Richard Price are educated and later teach. Until the middle of the 19th century, they are not allowed to go to university. So they're disenfranchised in that way. So that's dissenters. And that is why in Great Britain and later the United Kingdom, a lot of political radicalism is bound up with that religious radicalism and with these dissenters, whom we call nonconformists in the 19th century. And of course, Wales then, by 1851, Great Britain has a religious census. And this is when empire politics goes badly wrong, because that census proves that over 90% of the population of Wales on that Sunday go to chapel and not to state church. So this goes wrong, and it's proven that the Welsh are a nonconformist nation.
Hugh, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I mean, the end of the story there, so to speak, or that particular episode Marion refers to there, has within it the sort of irony or paradox, in as much as non-conformism becomes the conformism of Wales in the 19th century. And also that religious identity, I think it's fair to say, is also bound up to a degree with national identity. So that expression of religious independence is how in many ways the Welsh might be seen to be expressing their own autonomous self-determined identity in the 19th century. So, you know, political independence didn't really register as as an issue. There were questions around autonomy and self-rule, but the idea of, you know, political independence was not one that the Welsh were as interested in, certainly as compared to their religious independence. And there's one perhaps other slight paradoxical juxtaposition in the Welsh story, which is how non-conformism emerged as this conformist identity, which is to do with the particular circumstances in 18th century Wales, where a lot of this flowed from the Methodist revival. The Calvinist Methodists were particularly powerful In Wales, figures such as Hoel Harris, William Williams, Walter Kellyn, Daniel Rowland, these are the names from the 1730s and 1740s who stoked this revival. And the slight paradox irony there is that the Methodists were actually part of the Anglican Church, but they were the force that really sort of blew things open to an extent. And then the old dissenters, as it were, the Baptists, the Independents, and then emerging dissenters such as the Unitarians, joined, as it were, or became part of this religious upheaval that eventually led to Wales becoming this, you know, non-conformist nation, as Gladstone called us.
Just kind of to end the religious discussion now, would it be fair to say that many of these dissenters left Wales for the colonies because they thought they would be less repressed in some way than they were in Wales?
Absolutely. They leave early, you know, they're Quakers, and they flee from persecution. And then with emigration, you get these chains, you know, one person has gone, they send the next one. And then that kind of flight, it picks up again in the 1780s, particularly in the 1790s, when people like Morgan Jeanrees actually have to flee because they're being persecuted and prosecuted. So it is to do with economic opportunity. It's to do with the emergence of America, especially after 1776, as that utopia where you have religious liberty and everybody can worship in the way they wish to worship. But also, you know, so it's economic opportunity. It's the utopia of religious liberty, but it's also persecution.
You mentioned economic issues there, and maybe I can just ask both of you to comment on maybe the economic issue in Wales at the time. The previous episode, which you haven't heard, is about Ireland, and Benjamin Franklin went to Ireland in 1771 and 1772, and he was absolutely shocked by the miserable state of the Irish people. They lived in straw and mud hovels, he said. The poorest farmer in New England lived like a prince compared to the average Irish person. Was Wales in the same economic state of distress as Ireland, or at least the poor people of Ireland, were at that time?
Well, if you believe the first travelers to Wales, it is described as the backside of the word. It only becomes that Gothic thrill, that picturesque country once you have the war against France from 1793 and they cannot go on the Grand Tour and everything changes. In the 18th century, Wales is stagnant. It's very poor. Until the end of the 19th century, 80% of Welsh land is in the hands of some 50 families, the most powerful of whom are the Winds of Wednesday, who own a quarter of Wales, the northeast into England, and all the little tenant farmers, and that's similar to Ireland, I believe, depend on them. Now, I'm not sure whether the Welsh were quite as dirt poor as the Irish, but I know that if you were a Welsh hill farmer, kind of growing sheep for the wool, to sell to the Shrewsbury drapers who had the monopoly for cash, and the Shrewsbury drapers then sell it on via Liverpool to the slave islands and it becomes known as Welsh plaid, you lived close to starvation. And you had to take that cash for your raw fleece because there was nowhere else to sell. And this is where some of the Welsh hymns come from, Anne Griffiths and so on. And I believe that's where that intense religious Methodist spirituality that Hugh has talked about comes from. It's that poverty that, of course, seeks relief in believing that a better world is to come where everybody will be happy. So, yeah, Wales is until about the 1760s, 1770s, when industrialization sets in some corners of Wales. It's very rural. The largest town in Wales is Swansea. It has 6,000 inhabitants, and it's the only real urban space with kind of civic amenities in Wales. So it's poor, it's extremely rural, and most of the population are dependent on a very small class, a carapace of landowners, and their magistrates, their MPs, their county sheriffs. They basically control the whole country.
And that's interesting, because then by 1776, Philadelphia is a much bigger metropolis than Swansea is at the same time.
And there are probably more Welsh people living in Philadelphia. By 1800, there are 20,000 Welsh people living in London. I suspect in 1776, there may be more Welsh people living in Philadelphia than there are in Swansea.
Okay. We're going to get to the Declaration of Independence soon. Or, Hugh, did you want to?
Well, without wanting to delay us too much longer, I think there's an element of sort of the long durée that you need to take into consideration when understanding why Wales was perhaps so similar to Ireland. And that's to do with, with the historic colonisation of Wales that goes back to 1282. And, you know, the state of Wales, as it were, between that time and the Act of Union, when it formally became part of England in 1536 under Henry VIII, was, you know, what has been described by some historians as a state of apartheid. You know, a lot of the towns and economic centres were ruled and controlled by the English. And so from an early stage, after what I would say was actually a very bloody 150 years or so engaged with Norman forces, for that period, Wales becomes this backwater. And in some ways, things don't change an awful lot under Henry VIII. What happens is exactly what Marion described, this emergence of a sort of overclass that has the resources in the land, but the ordinary Welsh people are, you know, very much in a state that's similar to those to that of the Irish. And as Marion mentioned, some of this will change in the 18th and 19th century with industrialisation. And some of this as well obviously drives the Welsh out of Wales to London and to further afield, the Americas and so forth. And ultimately also will drive that emergent sense of sort of Welsh political identity as well.
Good. So, I mean, I think what we're trying to establish, and I don't want to make this comparison with Ireland overblown. It's just another example of another country that has this great influence over the United States and its founding. And Wales clearly is similar to Ireland in that respect. So certainly you talk about an underclass. You have the Irish Catholic underclass in Ireland, maybe Welsh, who are not the part of the rich, however many 50 families, potentially might or might not be considered an underclass in the same way that the Catholics are. But Wales has this tradition of dissent too, religious dissent. So we might draw that comparison with Ireland too. Economically, poor people struggled everywhere, and certainly the poor in Ireland and Wales struggled similarly, we could say. But the last point I want to make of comparison is about government. So in the 1770s, Ireland has an Irish parliament, but it doesn't really, it can't bring its own legislation to its own parliament, for example. So to what respect is it self-governing or at all? Well, not a lot. And we've argued in previous episodes that all of the individual North American colonies had much more power over their own legislative affairs than, say, the Irish did. This is all a segue into asking you guys about what is the state of Welsh governance in the 1770s?
Well, the Welsh
All of these questions, I just have to tell the audience, all of these questions make the guests' eyes open up very big. Like, I've just asked a question that requires a 10-hour answer.
I think the philosopher's eyes more than the historian's. For us, things are clear.
With this particular question, maybe there's a very short answer, Marion, which might be that, you know, there was very little political representation, or, you know, the political representation that existed was for that overclass who, you know, had their MPs that they sent down to London. And as such, you know, in a formal sense, Wales being taken into or annexed as part of the English state under the Act of Union in 1536 meant that the Welsh had some form of representation. But you might sort of describe that as a form of representation that, you know, saw Wales as a county or a region or a province of England, and one could not necessarily sort of point to that representation as, you know, representing Wales as a national entity. And certainly one would have to search far and wide to find any sort of sense in which, or evidence of that representation being for the, as it were, the downtrodden of Wales. But the immediate thought that came to my mind when you asked that question was, well, that's, you know, there's a short answer to that then, Andy.
Yeah. I mean, the short answer is that Wales has as much representation, or the common people of Wales have as much representation as the common people in England. Wales sends 32 MPs to London, but they represent 2% of the population. 2% of the population of Great Britain are enfranchised before the First Reform Act of 1832. So that's the first thing. Do they have a Welsh identity? Well, they are given a Welsh identity as outsiders, as an ethnic minority, and they are lampooned by cartoons. And we all know Georgian Britain is when you get caricature and lampooning and these cartoons flourishing. They're lampooned as the strange people that doesn't speak English properly. They ride on goats. You know, remember the goat is the Welsh, you know, regimental mascot. They're the three Watkin Williams Wynne brothers. You know, they may have been the princes of Wales and own quarter of Wales, but in England they are lampooned as riding carriages drawn by goats. And of course, all the Welsh always wear leeks in their hats. If you look at Hogarth's Prince, The Rake's Progress, the Welsh bum bailiffs wear leeks in their hats. They're smelly, they speak strange English, so they are lampooned. And the last aspect is that Wales in 1746, by the Berwick-upon-Tweed and Wales Act, disappears as a name. This is where the Encyclopaedia Britannica entry for Wales See England comes from, because that act states that whenever you say England, you mean Wales and Berwick-upon-Tweed as well. It resolves an anomaly, that act, and that act survives until, I think, after the Second World War.
I'm not sure I understand the significance of that act. Can you just tell me what you mean by resolves an anomaly?
Well, it not for myself. It's the anomaly is that it is not quite clear what Wales is, and it is not quite clear whether Berwick-upon-Tweed belongs to Scotland or England. So what they do, they pass the Wales and Berwick Act, which states that when we say England, we mean England and Wales. And when we say England, we mean Berwick-upon-Tweed as well.
I didn't realize the Berwick and Scotland connection, but about Wales, that's kind of what I've been trying to get at for this entire opening part of this discussion. What is it to mean Wales or England, or when you say Wales, what does it mean? And clearly this act says when you say England, you mean Wales, and when you say Wales, you mean Wales and England, which is this strange political factoid that confuses me still, even though you've explained it very well. But all of this is a way, or Hugh, did you want to say something?
I think in some ways, though, Andy, I wouldn't worry about being perhaps slightly perplexed, because in one way you're putting the finger on the confusion or mystery or paradox of Welsh identity, and that is the relationship between England and Wales, which is a hugely complex relationship that develops over centuries and still hangs over us today in many ways. I'm sure there would be another podcast or another podcast episode for this in an entirely different podcast series where you could just look at the historic relationship between Wales and England. And I think ultimately it's not only revealing about the period that we're discussing, but it's revealing about Welsh identity and English identity in the same way, because there's a sort of interdependence there that is not often recognised on the part of the English, but in some ways, you know, the Welsh identity became part of this British state that they forged, and they brought elements of the ancient British culture and mythology into that new English or British state. So, yes, don't feel worried about the fact that this is, you know, complex and somewhat mystifying, because I think it remains the same for many people in Wales today, you know?
Well, and the other reason I want to do this, and I want to get your Welsh nationalism going as we get into now discussing the American Declaration of Independence, now that I've kind of planted the seeds for you to really describe what Welsh identity is, the question is, well, why did you never declare independence? But that's perhaps a question for another topic. What we're talking about is Welsh sentiment about American rebellion in Wales. So, I made a bad joke, perhaps, but the serious point to make here is that here you have people in the North American colonies saying, we don't like this king, this distant king, this distant parliament making decisions for us anymore, which is a similar argument you could make if you were living on a hillside in Wales or somewhere in Ireland, potentially. And then, of course, we have all these Welsh Americans who are leaders of this concept of rebellion against a tyrant. And then, of course, we have the Declaration of Independence. So let's just move the discussion now to the American Declaration of Independence and try to get the sense of how maybe Welsh political philosophers, as we know Richard Price, influenced many of the founders, including the author of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson. So let's just try to start unpacking this big topic now, please. Who wants to start?
I can say a quick word about Richard Price in this context to kick us off, if you like, Andy, because I think in some ways connecting to the conversation that we've just had, there's an element of that paradox and complexity within Richard Price himself, who would refer to himself as a citizen of the world, but he would also refer to himself as an Englishman. But he was then again, a proud Welsh person who would go back to his childhood roots for his summer holidays. And it's I think beyond reasonable doubt that Richard Price was a Welsh speaker, at least in his youth. His sisters certainly were. And so his engagement with the whole question of the US is fascinating because it expresses that internal complexity. Because whilst he is waxing lyrical and he's writing these pamphlets, observations on civil liberty, that's published in the US in Philadelphia in 1776, the same week as the Declaration of Independence, that's a classic text, if you like, in extolling the virtues and the importance of independence, of liberty, of what he calls civil liberty. And he's obviously concentrating on the American case in this context, but he's also putting forward, I would say, if you like, philosophical first principles about the importance of non-domination, self-determination, and so forth. Yet, at the same time, there's no suggestion that Price would necessarily apply these arguments to his own people, if you like, the Welsh people. And so that, in a way, does, as I say, speak to the complexity we just mentioned. But of course, there were other radicals of that time, perhaps younger radicals as well from Wales, who would maybe take those conclusions in a different direction. But I think Price is emblematic and important and interesting, not just because of his connections with Franklin and the other Americans and his contribution to, if you like, the global, or at least the European and American conversation. It's also because he represents and embodies this tradition of dissent that we've been speaking to in the first part of the podcast.
Marion, did you want to add something there?
Yes. When I teach, Wales and the French Revolution or 18th century Welsh history, two names come up as Wales's greatest exports, and that's Richard Price and David Williams. And what is curious is both were born in Wales, both are Welsh speakers, both are dissenters, both become very influential philosophers in their time with strong connections, intellectual connections, correspondence with North America, and neither participated in those discussions in Wales itself, and neither kind of used their own mother tongue to publish, to develop their philosophical ideas. And there is a great disconnect between them and between what happens in Wales itself, what those dissenters and radicals are doing in Wales. So they've been described as of Wales, but not in Wales. And that's the first curiosity for me, the great disconnect. People like you and I, we're trying to kind of explore. The second disconnect is with regard to Richard Price as well. that he doesn't seem to be received and reworked his ideas directly in Wales in his own home country. The ideas of the American Revolution are received by Welsh Republicans like John Jones or Jack Lanagorse via translating Thomas Paine's Common Sense some 30 years later. But it's not the ideas, it's not Richard Price, it's Thomas Paine who's received. And it's Thomas Paine's publication from 1776 that's received and not Richard Price's publication from the same year. And that's very interesting. And again, it adds to that complexity of what is a discourse in Wales, what is a discourse of a Welshman, you know, how does a Welshman contribute to that global discourse? Because it seems to be either one or the other. You either contribute to that global discourse, to that global philosophy, or you contribute to the discourse in your own country, in the Welsh language, but you don't receive Richard Price.
Hugh, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, to agree with Marion there, and again, she's putting her finger on some of these historical complexities that we're still working our way around. And, you know, there are some examples. We've mentioned Morgan John Rhys. Another is perhaps Edward Williams, better known as Iolo Morgannwg, who in some ways maybe succeed in bridging the two worlds, if you like, the Welsh and the global. But again, I would ask the question as well, you know, to what extent those individuals you mentioned at the start of the show, Andy, those Americans with Welsh descent who were part of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, to what extent were they self-consciously Welsh, or to what extent did they, you know, champion their Welsh heritage? I'm not a historian and I'm not an expert in that context, but I would hazard a guess that perhaps it was not necessarily something that they pushed and perhaps performed. And that, I think, speaks again perhaps to this traversing, if you like, of the Welsh world and the Welsh language world and the global or the wider Anglophone world. I mentioned earlier this suggestion that in losing their language and their connected religious identity, Welsh Americans perhaps lost a substantive part of their Welsh identity. And I wonder if there's something there that once you traverse into Anglophone, wider intellectual world, it becomes perhaps more difficult to maintain and hold on to as well your Welsh language ideas, your Welsh language thinking, and, you know, inevitably perhaps you become part of different social circles. And this would probably be true of intellectuals today in Wales, you know, that there are two worlds that you're bridging and maintaining a presence or an influence in the both.
Yeah, Hugh, and maybe it's my fault for focusing so much on the Welsh identity aspect of the ideas, the political ideas of the Founding Fathers. Someone like Richard Price probably was just as convinced of the reason, you know, the rationality of his arguments for whatever he believed about political philosophy. So it doesn't necessarily need to come from a Welsh identity perspective when we're talking about Price. If, you know, like Thomas Paine, Price is making arguments about the sort of logical imperative of a certain type of descent or freedom to make decisions about one's society and oneself.
Absolutely. You know, whilst I would hold to the hypothesis or claim that, you know, Price was a product of Welsh descent and embodied a lot of what was important to aspects of Welsh descent at that time, that's not to say that he was expressing his ideas with his Welsh identity necessarily being central to exploring those ideas and articulating them. I mean, as I mentioned, he describes himself, especially towards the end of his life, more and more as a citizen of the world. And I think that is, you know, one way in which we might understand Price and perhaps others in the same tradition. And in that context, as you say, you know, it's important not always to analyze and try to interpret what's being said and spoken by intellectuals such as Price in the context of the intellectual biography, so to speak. And, you know, I think that's one of the interesting or enduring elements of Price's appeal, that his ideas and principles speak to us across the ages. You know, often when I'm teaching Christ now, in the context of the sort of politics that we're facing today, you'll see many of the same themes reemerge. So, you know, Price, in many senses, although he's a patriot and he writes a famous sermon called The Discourse on the Love of Our Country in 1789 in response to the outbreak of the French Revolution, despite that, he emphasizes the importance of being universal citizens and thinking about the happiness and the good of the entire world. He doesn't reject nationalism straight out, but he does say that nationalism has to be tempered by these rationalist considerations, by the idea that we should be moving to an international society that's shot through rather than with competition, rather than with cooperation. He is very much in favour of moving away from a sort of strong, sort of abrasive nationalism. You know, that's something that he wants to try to subdue, as it were. And so all these ideas, I think, with Price are striking in terms of how contemporary they are, how they remain then equally important today. And one other element I'll mention before perhaps hand over to Marion is that, you know, he puts an incredible emphasis on the importance of information, of truth, as it were, in the public sphere. And, you know, in the age of the internet and in the age that we're in, that's sometimes described as post-truth, there's an awful lot that really rings true in Price's analysis of how a functioning democracy should develop, and at the heart of that is not only the pursuit of virtue, but also the importance of truth and the importance of understanding and information, and that, you know, the masses, as it were, are inevitably going to fall foul of the powerful if they are unable to understand the world around them.
You use the word functioning democracy as if it's a word that Price might use. Could you just maybe gloss that for me?
Yes, of course. And this is another interesting element of Price, where he becomes perhaps not necessarily the firebrand radical that we've been, you know, conditioned to sort of think of him as, but rather he becomes more of a sort of gradualist, in as much as he very much believed in the ideal of democracy and believed in the idea of working towards greater representation over time. But as with a number of, for want of a better phrase, Republican thinkers of that time, so Immanuel Kant comes to mind, there's very much this fear or this sense in which we have to try and tie political representation and political participation to independence. So Price was certainly in favour of working towards a greater enfranchisement of the people, was in favour of democracy as a principle, but wasn't one of the more radical Democrats who sort of pushed for universal franchise immediately. He saw that, as I say, democratic participation was tied to your ability to be independent, because the fear was, if you're not independent in terms of your means, then you are open to being exploited by the powerful. And of course, adjacent to that question about, you know, the universal franchise is, of course, the role of women, and the relationship with Mary Wollstonecraft is an interesting one there, where, of course, Wollstonecraft would have been a big critic of Price and others of that generation in not understanding and not acknowledging that a movement towards greater enfranchisement also included women.
Oh, and now I want to ask a follow-up question about potentially slavery, but I think Marian has been wanting to say something for a while. Marian?
It's very interesting that Hugh thinks people regard Richard Price as a firebrand. The Welsh writers and poets I work with are much more firebrandish than Richard Price. For me, Richard Price, and especially his observations on civil liberty, he's a political philosopher. It's a very kind of ordered philosophical tractat, isn't it? What he does for us, and I think that is under the influence and corresponding to the American Revolution, is he sorts out liberty for us. And liberty has to be, there are different kinds. There's natural liberty, which has to be tempered with civil liberty. And that's the kind of liberty he sees in America. So, and there is a difference between that and, of course, a discourse on the love of country, which he publishes, you know, it's less than a year before his death as an old man, when he kind of has been sparked into life again by that French Revolution. And of course, Price is also, he's not a Republican as such. He is a constitutional monarchist, where you have, you know, houses of parliament, but you do have a monarch. I mean, even at the end of his life, he writes, you know, who is the monarch but the first servant of the nation? You know, and the nation has the right to cashier the monarch, but there is a monarch there. And this is before, you know, this is before Burke. This is in 1789, when everybody in Great Britain is thinking, great, the French are finally throwing off the shackles of absolutist monarchy, and they're following 1688 and the Glorious Revolution. This is great. So far about Price. For me, the other thing about Price as a kind of global philosopher, as a citizen of the world, is maybe we can kind of bind this or explain this just with geography as well. Of course, he goes back to Wales for his holidays and so on, but he is at the center of power. You know, he is first a Unitarian. You know, he teaches at an academy. He's a Unitarian minister. He lives in London. He's at Newington Green. That's where the parliament is. That's where, you know, everybody assembles. That's where the ideas come in. And of course, he speaks English every day. You know, he does not preach or read in Welsh. It's in English. These ideas come in English or maybe in French, of course. And so this is his world. His world is not that of rural Wales or even 6,000 inhabitants Swansea. His world is at the heart of the empire. And as such, he takes part in empire politics and he takes part in empire discourses and correspondence. So for me, it's a question of just geography as well. He is part of an ethnic minority right at the center of power there. And he's a philosopher.
If I can add as well, Marion, I think, you know, the scope that we're dealing with here is important as well, in as much as the American and French Revolution, in some senses, is a period of time which is relevant, I would say, to the development of not just Price, but other contemporaries. And that in some ways, we can't necessarily take them as two events apart, because a lot of what happens in terms of the debate and discourse, as I understand it, back in Wales, is that potentially the French Revolution has more of an impact than the American, but that, as I say, there's an interrelation there. And my note about Price as the firebrand reflects some of this, because, you know, as you mentioned, Burke is a figure who's looming on the horizon, and a lot of our reception of Price is in some ways refracted through Burke's attempt to present Price not just as a radical firebrand, but as a problem, a huge problem for the British establishment.
As a king killer.
Exactly, yeah. So,
well, here's a question for both of you. Firebrand, gradualist, these are two terms I've heard to describe Price, constitutional monarchist. How would he be reading these words in the Declaration of Independence himself? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, is he 100% agreeing with all those statements, or does he have a different sort of approach to these core American founding concepts?
My sense is that he would be on board, to use a colloquialism, and the question of Price's radicalism and political radicalism is not an easy one. A couple of years ago, Marion and I were part of an event here in Cardiff University where we were celebrating the tricentenary of Price's birth. And a well-known political philosopher who's a Price expert, Yiftah Elitzar, was giving a paper on that particular question of whether or not Price was a Republican, because as Marion has mentioned, in some ways he was careful to present himself as being, you know, something other than, if you like, a firebrand Republican. And in that context, again, I would probably come back to this word gradualist as being an important element of Price's political outlook and philosophical outlook, because although on the one hand, I think he would be very comfortable in extolling, you know, the principles that you've just read out, and, you know, more generally, he would have been somebody who was extolling the idea that there are objective moral ideas that exist as part of the wider moral law, if we briefly sort of move into his ethical outlook. At the same time, I think he was more of a political realist, perhaps, than we might credit him for, in terms of how those principles might be achieved over time. And I think, you know, you mentioned slavery earlier. This is one of the questions with this particularly difficult sort of relationship between the ideals and the realities and the political and economic realities faced Price, because he was very much an abolitionist. It was part of his political outlook, as it was many of his contemporaries within Welsh descent, you know, from different theological perspectives also. And Price indeed, you know, challenged Jefferson in the late 80s, when they were, as it were, pen pals, on this very question, and was, you know, demanding to know from Jefferson, well, how can you extol these ideas of liberty and equality from within a political order where, you know, people such as yourself, Thomas, you know, keep slaves. And, you know, although Price challenged and obviously, you know, pushed, I think he also would have perhaps recognised that these changes are not things that would necessarily happen overnight. And I think there's an interesting question around his interpretation, his response to the French Revolution, because in 1789, he welcomes it and he sees this as part of the sort of millenarian development towards the age of justice and peace on earth. But had he lived to see what happened in terms of the sort of development of the French Revolution, he would have been appalled by it. And I think that maybe reflects, as I say, this gradualism and realism that was also part of Price's political outlook.
I just want to make a quick point about Jefferson before Marion comes in here. Jefferson hated it when people questioned the obvious contradictions of the Declaration of Independence and his own keeping of slaves. I think personally that it just wasn't something that he could resolve, and he just preferred that people not raise it to him. And it was easier for the people much closer to him to avoid that subject, because they could tell he couldn't sit with it. And so it was better to ignore, which is a psychological point or something else. But I think it's interesting that Price would have pushed him. I just know that when Price was pushing Jefferson in these letters, Jefferson was not happy.
Yeah, as I well imagine. And I suppose as well, one could speak to the sort of the realities of the economic system and what it would have meant for the families of people like Jefferson were they to move towards abolitionism.
Marion?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here since you've addressed, you know, slavery, the enslaved, and, you know, it makes me think of imperialism. Thinking about the American Declaration of Independence, I think Price would have wholeheartedly welcomed it. And if you read his diaries, he's a very optimistic and positive person. He writes things like, "I love all the world," and things like that. So of course he would have welcomed it. But of course, and of course he criticizes Jefferson for, you know, keeping slaves. But when you look at some of his writings, and what I've started doing recently is I've always read Price, but more my own authors, you know, Morgan John Rhys, Iolo Morganwg, Jack Llanygors, all these radical Welsh authors. I've read them as radicals, and I've read them as subaltern kind of sufferers from British persecution. But when I teach this now, and I've just started my semester with Richard Price's For the Love of Our Country, it's pretty imperialist, and it's anti-Semitic, it's imperialist. So I'm starting to read all these radical writings against the grain as texts of their time, And sometimes that's not pretty. So, and of course, you all know the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of, you know, the Rights of Man and Citizen. That means white males. It doesn't mean women, and it doesn't mean anybody else, and it doesn't mean anybody, you know, outside kind of so-called Western democracy. It sometimes doesn't even, it doesn't even mean men over 25 who are paupers or haven't got, you know. So we need to kind of, we need to read these texts against the grain as well, and not just with respect to slavery, but also for me with respect to empire. And once you start reading them in that way, you just can't stop. And things sometimes, you know, you lose a tiny little bit of respect for these heroes. Sorry, Hugh.
I wouldn't disagree with you, Marian. I mean, it's not just the people you've mentioned that Price has some unkind words for in a discourse on the love of our country. But I think as well in that respect, you know, read against the grain, but you also read in the context of where the debate is at that time. And I think in that respect, it is fascinating to look at people like Morgan John Rees in particular, who, as you say, has that sort of subaltern element to his view of the world. And I find the comparison between those two particularly fascinating, because Morgan John Rees also goes out, doesn't he, to America, and, you know, comes to some really interesting conclusions about where the Welsh, as it were, should position themselves. And, you know, he sees the place of the Welsh in the world next to the indigenous people in support of those who've been enslaved. And I would almost suggest that his more self-conscious Welshness, his continuing engagement and speaking of the language, I would suggest perhaps leads him to a slightly different and more radical, and as you suggest, Marian, slightly more subaltern view of the world than what we get in Price's later pamphlet, The Discourse on the Love of Our Country, which has, you know, a lot of virtues to it, some of which I've already sort of mentioned. Yeah, I am not going to debate with you the extent of his imperialism in that pamphlet, Marian, but I might sort of question the extent to which we can see him as a British imperialist, given some of the arguments. But I think very much if you then, as I say, compare, and as you suggest, Marian, read these texts against the grain, you find that there are other contemporaries with more radical, more emancipatory views. And there's a sense in which you have to, I think, maybe compare more with the contemporaries, as opposed to, of course, the anachronistic kind of technique of reading these thinkers back through, you know, from our own time, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Of course, they're of their time. And I'm not saying Richard Price was an imperialist by all means, but they're just these pieces in there and you go, oh, Richard, you know. And of course, even Morgan John Rees, it's quite complex. He has to flee from persecution in 1794 because he publishes a radical Welsh periodical. He is about to be arrested in Carmarthen. He goes to Liverpool, he travels over, and he founds what now survives as Cambria County, which is supposed to be a utopian settlement without a king, where kind of white and black people worship together in one chapel. He's a Baptist. He uses these Baptist networks. But on the other hand, of course, that land, that is land of the, you know, indigenous people of America he inhabits. So it's very complex. You have a movement of flight from persecution. You have kind of a kind of utopian settlement where there are no enslaved people. But that utopian settlement is part of a colonization effort. So they're very complex movements. And here in Wales, historians, until recently, we have only, and, you know, I myself, I'm guilty of that. We've only interpreted them as movements of flight and as movements of radicalism and so on, not as participation as a subaltern in colonization movements. So we have to do, it's complex. You know, it's neither nor, it's everything together. It's a complex history.
I'm going to leave it at the complex history so we don't get too much into opposing viewpoints here. But I just have one theme before we close that I want you to discuss. And you've already, Marian, started discussing it. And that's just how the American Declaration of Independence started and has affected the sense of Welsh republicanism, Welsh national identity back in Wales.
Well, there is a delayed response to the Declaration of Independence. In 1776, and remember, Wales is kind of, it's dominated by religious publications. It's different from Ireland and Scotland in that you have Welsh printing, but that printing is religious, so mostly. So you have some ballads about, you know, what's happening over there, sensationalist. And you have two translations of political pamphlets into Welsh from English. They're both supportive of the colonists and of the Declaration of Independence. But then you get a long time nothing. And then, you know, the echoes are picked up in the 1790s by Welsh republicans like Jack Lanagors, who writes, "Oh, that our forefathers were not like the good people of America and throw off their king. We would still be in possession of the whole island of Britain." In the 1790s, you get poems to America, to kind Benjamin Franklin. They're the hope of humanity. So you get all that in the 1790s. And then what happens, of course, remember you have 23 years of war then, until the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815. And what happens then is in Victorian Wales, starts to whitewash itself. It's the land of the white gloves where no big crime happens. All the cultural institutions are taken over by the new industrialists and the old gentry. They are anglicizing it. It's the land of music and so on. And all radicals, you know, among them Richard Price, American Revolution, French Revolution, they're forcibly forgotten or they're whitewashed. And what happens with the United States of America and the Declaration of Independence is you get that pride in the Welsh founder fathers. You get endlessly that pride recycled in how many Welsh signatories there were, how many Welsh generals were fighting in the wars on the American side, how many presidents of Welsh descent there were. And that goes all the way down, of course, to Hillary Clinton being made, I think, an honorary professor at Swansea, or she gets the honor of Swansea because apparently she is of vaguely Welsh descent. So the pride is, and for me, it's not a pride in the Declaration of Independence. It's pride in the men who made America great. Sorry about the pun. So it's not a radical thing. The radical Welsh tradition starts again with that working class tradition, with the Chartists and so on. They don't reference back to the American Declaration of Independence. And I see that going through to this day. It's a pride in, you know, in the Welsh who live overseas there. We have them on the radio sometimes, on Radio Cymru. It's a pride in the people who've kept the traditions, who fly the red dragon and so on. It's not a remembrance or a pride in the Declaration of Independence.
Hugh?
Yeah, it's interesting to reflect, I think, on the relationship between Wales and the US today. And exactly what Marion was speaking to there, which is, you know, a sense of pride in those that have made it stateside. And, you know, that deep sense of connection with anything Welsh that happens anywhere in the world, I think that's maybe reflective of a minority and minoritized culture, not just with reference to the language, but also with reference to our identity as a whole. Those who have made it, as it were, on the world stage or have done something to promote the good name of Wales are feted and celebrated. And that's partly, as I say, to do with this relative anonymity that the Welsh have. You know, you were making the comparisons with the Scottish and the Irish earlier, it's very rarely actually that people will know of or will recognise, or they will need some prompting, or you'll have to reference somebody. When I was a teenager, it would have been the footballer Ryan Giggs. Older people might refer to Tom Jones, the entertainer. These days, people might reference Gareth Bale or even Jess Fishlock, who's, you know, a Welsh footballer who's played for a long time over in the States. And so within that sort of outlook, if you like, in that frame of mind and mentality, as Marion said, it's that idea that, you know, somewhere, somehow, people of Welsh descent, of Welsh origin, have contributed to, yeah, the development and building of the modern world. And I think, you know, nowadays, of course, with what's happening in the US in terms of politics, that again is becoming a slightly more complicated relationship, and it's difficult, I think, or more difficult to take for, you know, straightforward pride in those Welsh connections with America because of, you know, what's occurring, as it were, over there. And of course, you know, that's following similar political trends back here in the UK and Europe. And I think in that context, of course, you know, the principles we've been speaking to and those ideals, as I mentioned earlier, are still, of course, as relevant as ever.
Yeah, and Hugh, before we get to the final thing, and I will give you the final word as the political philosopher here. We're coming to an end, and I do want us to reflect. I ask all my guests to reflect on what you think the 250-year anniversary of this document that everyone knows. What are your big takeaways? What do you think it's important to remember in the 250-year anniversary? Marion, let's start with you.
Whew, that is a huge question. The most exciting of Welsh historians, Gwynarf Williams, once wrote, "Politics in Wales starts with the American Revolution." Now, while I'm not 100% on board with that, I do think that the American Declaration of Independence is the kind of signal, the starting signal for a lot of movements towards democracy in Europe. It gives hope to British campaigners. You know, the Society for Constitutional Information is revived and so on. And that echoes through to Wales, to other countries in Europe. So for me, it's the kind of, you know, if you have a, it's a signal, you know, you give at sea. And Welsh Republican Jack Lanagos wrote one of the pamphlets in which he uses Thomas Paine's Common Sense, written in 1776. It's called Seren Tan Gwmol, A Star Under a Cloud. And the star is liberty. It's under a cloud. And it's the American Revolution that starts to kind of blow those clouds away. So for me, it's a starting point. It's a signal. It's the beginning of our tradition of modern democracy. So of course, it's worth celebrating.
Hugh?
So next year, 2026, in the month of May, we have our Senedd elections, parliamentary elections for our Senedd, our Senate down in Cardiff. In some ways, I think it's timely to reflect on, you know, the Declaration of Independence, the principles therein, and also, you know, in a broader sense, what that was all about, as it were, and why you had radicals such as Price back in London and others back in Wales taking an interest in this and why it impacted the course of history so much. And that, of course, is to do with objection to arbitrary rule. It's to do with questions of political justice. It's to do with, you know, these emerging ideals and emerging structures that people were fighting for. And it feels like these principles, these conversations, these debates, I would say they need to happen again. That's not just the political philosopher in me saying that. I'm saying that as a citizen both of Wales, of the UK, and a citizen of the world. And so for my money, I think, you know, the importance of a podcast like this, of conversations around the Declaration of Independence, it's an opportunity for us all to reflect, isn't it, on where we've arrived today. I think the virtues and the values in that document that we should be seeking to reassert and discuss and to reinvigorate. But also, I think what Marion perhaps alluded to earlier as well, in terms of, you know, the context of that document, how we might read it against the grain, and how that also might inform us in terms of taking forward democratic politics, justice and peace in the world. You know, it's that document and the opportunity to reflect on it is absolutely invaluable. And I'd like to thank you in that context, Andy, for the opportunity to be able to discuss with you and Marion, because it's these kind of conversations that are so, so important at this juncture in history. I don't know, Marion, if you'd agree with that as a historian, but that's certainly how I feel about that.
Absolutely. And yeah, thank you for stressing that as well. It is important, especially at this time. And of course, we are not looking forward to that election in 2026, because, you know, I feel like you, that our democracy here in Wales is under siege. So we need to remind ourselves what those basic values are that we campaign for and we want to uphold, and to advertise those basic values, whether that's in North America, whether that's over here.
Well, there are good models from the United States of Welsh ancestry who can guide you towards republicanism. And we will end with that. Dr. Marion Loeffler, Dr. Hugh Williams, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Just like. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americanzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The American Zentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the American Zentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americanzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.